Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really digging into something fundamental, the material that, well, basically built the modern world, steel. It's still, I think you'd agree, the most successful structural material out there.
Oh, absolutely. No question.
I mean, just think about the range. You've got simple rebar holding up buildings, but then you have these incredibly complex alloys in jet engines. Steel is just everywhere.
Right. And even looking forward, you know, Elon Musk building Starship, this huge spacecraft out of stainless steel.
Exactly. Not fancy composites or aluminum, but steel. It says so much about its sheer capability and, well, cost effectiveness, too.
Definitely. But the genius isn't just mixing iron and carbon. It's how we manipulate that mix afterwards.
That's the core of what we looked at today, isn't it? This idea that it's changing from one structure, one crystal arrangement to another actually takes time. It's not instant.
It's a kinetic process, a bottleneck, as you said.
So the real challenge, the questions we need to tackle are, you know, how does that transformation speed change with time and temperature? Can we actually cool it fast enough to trap these non-equilibrium structures?
And crucially, are those structures actually better, mechanically stronger, tougher?
That's the mission, then. We're mapping out this interplay between cooling, time, and the final properties.
Exactly. We'll start with the equilibrium map, the Tec-C phase diagram that tells us where things should end up given enough time.
But the real action is in the time-temperature transformation diagrams, the TTT charts.
Precisely. Those are the practical guides. That's how engineers actually control the process, and we'll kind of cheat the equilibrium clock.
Okay, let's lay the groundwork. Starting point. Austenite usually forms when steel gets hot, say, above 900 degrees C.
Yeah, for most common steels, that's the zone. Austenite, symbol gamma. It's got that face-centered cubic structure, FCC.
FCC, like stacking oranges, nice and dense.
That's a good way to picture it. Dense, symmetrical. And importantly, austenite can dissolve a fair bit of carbon, but it's only happy at high temperatures.
So as soon as you cool it.
It wants to change. It wants to decompose into ferrite, which is alpha, that's body-centered cubic, BCC.
BCC, less tightly packed oranges.
Sort of, yeah. And the other product is cementite, Tec-C3. That's an intermetallic compound, a hard, brittle stuff.
And cementite is technically metastable, right? It's not the absolute final equilibrium.
You're spot on. Given enough time, and especially with silicon present, the carbon would rather form pure graphite. But for almost all steels we use, that's just too slow to worry about.
So we stick with the iron carbide system.
We do. And yeah. The key reaction within that system is the eutectoid transformation.
Okay.
That's where austenite transforms into both ferrite and cementite simultaneously. It happens right at 727 degrees C, but only if the carbon content is exactly 0.76 weight percent.
That's the eutectoid composition. And 727 C is the equilibrium temperature.
The theoretical line.
Yeah.
But for anything to actually happen.
You need to cool below that line. You need some undercooling, delta T toolers. Otherwise, nothing happens.
Exactly. No driving force, no change. And that 0.76% carbon, that's the dividing line.
For hypo and hypertectoid steel.
Right. Less than 0.76% C, it's hypertectoid. More than that, it's hyperutectoid.
And if you cool them really slowly, let equilibrium sort of take over.
The microstructure tells you which is which. Hypotectoid steel first drops out some ferrite, usually the old austenite grain boundaries.
Yeah.
That makes the remaining austenite richer in carbon.
Until it hits 0.76% C.
Correct. And with hyperutectoid, it's the opposite. Cementite forms first, taking carbon out of the austenite.
Until it also gets down to 0.76% C.
Exactly. And in both cases, that remaining austenite, now at the magic 0.76%, finally transforms into perlite.
Perlite. Okay, let's focus there. That's the classic slow-cooled structure, this mix of ferrite and cementite layers.
An intimate mixture, yeah. Formed simultaneously from the parent austenite. Looks like mother of pearl under the microscope, hence the name.
Now, here's where it gets interesting kinetically. You mentioned the transformation rate increases with undercooling, with delta T.
It does. The further you cool below 727C, the faster the austenite wants to transform.
But wait, if lower temperature means faster transformation, what's the catch? Why not always cool it lower, say to 600 C instead of, I don't know, 675 C?
Good question. That gets right to the core of controlling properties. The catch is the fineness of the structure.
Meaning?
The rate speeds up, yes, but the layers of ferrite and cementite that form get thinner and closer together. So if you cool just a little bit below 727 C, maybe to 675 C.
Higher temperature, smaller delta time.
Right. You get coarse perlite, wider layers. It's relatively soft, more ductile.
Okay. And if you cool further down, a larger delta T, say 600 C.
Then you get fine perlite. Much thinner layers, packed tightly, those fine layers are really effective at blocking dislocations from moving.
Which makes it harder.
Significantly harder, yes, but also less ductile. It's always a trade-off.
What's the mechanism behind that growth, though? How can it keep going if ferrite wants almost no carbon and cementite wants loads of it?
It's a clever bit of local diffusion. Think of the transformation front moving to the austenite.
Mm.
The growing ferrite layer basically pushes carbon atoms out of its way.
Into the austenite just ahead of it.
Exactly. And the growing cementite layer, which is right next door, needs that carbon. So it effectively gobbles up the carbon that the ferrite rejected.
Ah, so it's like a little local partitioning system.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Ferrite rejects carbon, cementite absorbs it. This keeps the austenite composition right at the interface pretty much constant, allowing the whole layered structure to grow steadily forward at a constant rate.
Wow, a self-sustaining decomposition front. Okay, so this variability, same starting material, but different cooling gives different layer spacing and thus different hardness. This is why the simple phase diagram isn't enough, right?
Absolutely. You need a map that includes time, and that's the TTT diagram, time temperature transformation.
The map for these non-equilibrium games, how do they make those?
Conceptually, you take samples of austenite, rapidly cool them down, quench them to a specific temperature below 727C, and then hold them there.
Amazing.
Isothermal treatment.
Hold them steady.
And you just time it. How long does it take for the transformation to start? How long until it's finished? You repeat this at different temperatures.
And plotting that gives you the TTT curve. Often C-shaped.
That's the one. The nose of the C curve represents the temperature where the transformation happens fastest. Above or below the nose, it takes longer.
Okay, using that TTT map then, what other structures can we get besides perlite? Ones that still need carbon to move around.
Well, if you cool it to temperatures below where you'd get that fine perlite, but still above where martensite forms, you can get bainite.
Bainite. Is it still layers?
No. Structurally, it's quite different. It's still diffusion controlled, meaning carbon atoms have to move. But instead of layers, you get very fine, often elongated particles of cementite dispersed within a matrix of ferrite.
So needle-like or feathery structure sometimes.
Yeah, that's often how it looks. Mechanically, bainite offers a nice balance. It's generally harder and stronger than perlite, especially coarse perlite, but often tougher than the finest perlite.
Interesting. So perlite, then bainite, as we cool faster, or rather cool to lower holding temperatures.
Correct. Now, we've been talking about cooling down, but what if you want the absolute opposite? Maximum softness, maybe for machining or forming.
You mentioned reheating.
Exactly. That leads us to spheroidite. This isn't something you get directly by cooling austenite.
So how do you make it?
You start with something that already has cementite in it, usually perlite or bainite, and you heat it up, but keep it just below the eutectoid temperature, below 727C, and you hold it there for a long, long time.
Hours, days.
Often 18, 24 hours, maybe longer, depending on the steel and the starting structure.
What's happening during that long soak?
The driving force is simply minimizing surface energy. Those flat plates or needles of cementite and perlite or bainite are energetically unfavorable compared to spheres.
Oh, lowest surface area for a given volume.
You got it. So the cementite particles slowly break up and ball up into little spheres dispersed within the soft ferrite matrix.
And because spheres have minimal interface area and the matrix is soft ferrite,
it becomes the softest, most ductile, most easily machinable microstructure you can get in steel.
Mm.
Really useful if you need to do a lot of cold working or drawing to shape a part before final hardening.
Okay, perlite, bainite, spheroidite, all involve carbon moving around. Now for the speed run, the rapid quench.
Now we get to martensite. And the key thing here, martensite is not on the equilibrium phase diagram.
Because it forms too fast for equilibrium.
Exactly. It's a product of speed. The transformation from austenite, FCC, to martensite is incredibly rapid and crucially diffusionless.
Diffusionless, meaning the carbon atoms don't move.
They don't have time, not even one atomic jump. They get trapped exactly where they were in the original austenite lattice. So the chemical composition of martensite is identical to the austenite it formed from.
And because there's no diffusion involved, the amount that transforms doesn't depend on how long you hold it at temperature.
Correct. It depends only on how far you cool below a critical temperature called the martensite start temperature, or M. The lower you go below AMSAL, the more martensite you form. Time is irrelevant once you're below AMSAL, assuming you got there fast enough to miss the perlite and bainite noses on the TTT curve.
So the carbon atoms are literally stuck, wedged into a crystal structure they don't really fit in?
That's the essence of it. The underlying iron atoms want to rearrange from FCC, austenite, to BCC, ferrite, but the trapped carbon atoms get in the way.
And what structure does that create?
If there's enough carbon, typically above about 0.15 weight percent, the structure isn't quite BCC. It gets distorted into a body-centered tetragonal or BCT structure.
Tetragonal, like a stretched cube.
Exactly. Stretched along one axis, the trapped carbon atoms force this distortion.
And that distortion is the key to its properties.
Absolutely. That BCT structure has far fewer easy ways for dislocations to move compared to BCC ferrite. Plus, the carbon atoms themselves, sitting in those interstitial sites, create huge strain fields in the lattice,
making it hard for dislocations to get past.
Incredibly hard. It's a very potent strengthening mechanism. That's why martensite is famously hard and strong.
Yeah.
But
there's always a but.
It's also very brittle, minimal ductility. And it's worth noting, if you had martensite with almost no carbon, it wouldn't be particularly strong. It's the trapped carbon causing that BCT distortion that delivers the hardness.
Okay, so we've dodged perlite and bainite, quenched super fast, and made this incredibly hard but brittle martensite. That doesn't sound very useful for, say, a bridge or a car part.
It isn't. Not usually in its quenched state. It's too brittle. That brings us to the essential final step for almost all martensitic steels.
Tempering.
Tempering. So heating it up again. Heating it up again, yes, but carefully. Well below the temperature where austenite would start to form again. Usually somewhere between, say, 200 and maybe 700 degrees C, depending on the steel and the desired properties.
What's the goal of tempering?
It's a controlled relaxation. You're letting that highly stressed, brittle martensite structure ease up just enough to gain some toughness back.
How does it relax? Does the carbon finally get to move?
It does. At typical tempering temperatures, say 200 to 400 C, the trapped carbon atoms finally get enough thermal energy to diffuse short distances. They start to precipitate out.
As cementite.
Initially, often as a less stable transitional carbide, sometimes called epsilon carbide, TEXVP4, which then converts to the more stable cementite particles.
And taking the carbon out of the BCT lattice lets it relax back towards BCC ferrite.
Pretty much. The structure becomes much less strained. This precipitation and relaxation process causes a definite drop in hardness and strength compared to the as-quenched martensite.
But the trade-off is?
A huge gain in toughness and ductility. You trade some of that peak hardness for the ability to actually absorb energy without shattering. That's the critical compromise for making useful parts.
Okay, but what about applications where you need strength at high temperatures, like inside a turbine? Tempering sounds like it softens the steel.
Standard tempering does. But this is where alloy design gets clever. If you add specific alloying elements, strong carbide formers like vanadium, molybdenum, chromium, tungsten.
Things that like to bond with carbon more than iron does.
Exactly. Then you can do something called secondary hardening. This happens when you temper at higher temperatures, maybe above 500 C.
What occurs differently then?
Instead of just forming iron carbides, these alloying elements precipitate out as their own extremely fine, very stable carbides. Think vanadium carbide or molybdenum carbide.
And these are different from cementite.
Very different. They are incredibly fine, they resist coarsening at high temperatures, and they provide significant strengthening themselves. This precipitation of fine alloy carbides can actually cause hardness to increase again during high temperature tempering, hence secondary hardening.
Ah, so you get the toughness benefit from relieving the initial martensite strain, but then you get renewed strength from these stable alloy carbides.
Precisely. It's an engineered microstructure that retains strength and resists softening even when operating hot for long periods. That's how components like steam turbine rotors can run reliably for years at 500, even over 600 degrees Celsius.
That really shows how controlling these non-equilibrium structures gives superior properties, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's proof that deliberately avoiding equilibrium is often the key to performance.
So looking back, we've gone from slow cooling giving layered perlite to slightly faster cooling or lower temperatures giving bainite.
Then the long reheat giving soft spheroidite.
To the ultra-fast quench for hard, brittle martensite.
And finally, tempering that martensite, sometimes with secondary hardening, to get that crucial balance of strength and toughness.
It's quite a spectrum of possibilities from just iron and carbon, maybe with a few extra elements.
It really is. And if you line up the mechanical properties, martensite is strongest and hardest, but least ductile. Spheroidite is the softest and most ductile.
And perlite, bainite, and tempered martensite fill the range in between.
Exactly. Tempering, in particular, lets engineers dial in the properties they need, finding that sweet spot between strength and toughness for a specific application.
It seems like the whole story of practical metallurgy, based on what we've discussed, revolves around managing time and temperature to get the mechanical properties you actually want.
Yeah.
It's about manipulating those kinetic pathways.
That's a perfect summary. It's all about controlling the transformation kinetics to achieve a desired microstructure, because structure dictates properties.
So to wrap up, what's a final thought for our listeners to chew on, building on this?
Well, think about those huge components, like a massive steel rotor for a power plant generator. When you cool something that big after forging or heat treatment, can you really cool the inside and the outside at the same rate?
No way. The surface must cool much, much faster than the deep core.
Right. So true isothermal transformation, like on those TTT diagrams, is impossible in practice for large parts. The cooling rates vary dramatically through the cross-section.
So what does that imply for alloy design?
It means a lot of clever commercial alloy design isn't just about making transformations happen fast to get martensite. It's often about intentionally slowing down certain transformations.
Slowing them down? How?
By adding elements like manganese, for example. It pushes those perlite and bainite noses on the TTT diagram further out to longer times. This is called increasing hardenability.
Why would you want to slow it down?
So that even the slowly cooling core has enough time to miss the perlite and bainite transformations entirely, and can still transform to the desired structure, perhaps martensite or bainite, matching the surface. You need the transformation to be sluggish enough to allow the entire part to achieve a uniform, useful microstructure upon cooling to room temperature.
Ah, so it's about ensuring consistency across the whole piece, even with the different cooling rates.
Exactly. So the provocative thought is this. How much of advanced materials engineering is actually about carefully designing things to happen more slowly, to give us the control we need, rather than just pushing for maximum speed?